publishing businesses. Houghton Mifflin.
Oh?
Can't you just leave the...
Is he planning to do something on Drybrook?
I don't know. He has a little property here, a little piece of land, and always wants to build here, so he loves it here. And he's a very clever man. He's made a lot of money, but remember, he wouldn't... No.
All right. Mike told me that his first recollections were when he went to live at the Clark House. Do you know where that was?
The Clark House is over what we call Clark Point. It's just above the forge and the little red schoolhouse there, the old
mm-hmm.
schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little road winds up there to a spring, and there's an old house there, or there was until recently when it was torn down. That's known as the Clark House. Mike must have had the early days there. I don't know where, I don't think he was born there. He may have been, but of course.
No,
he lived in the head of Dry Brook in the Christian, mm-hmm. on what we know today as the Christian place.
Mm-hmm.
Just an old log house. That's gone now, but I remember it well.
Well, he said that then he went on to recollect about his father. His father was very strict, and he told one story of how once his father was working with the oxen, and something happened, and the father had to get up near the ox, and he tickled the belly of the ox, and he gave his father quite a kick, and his father whipped him until the blood came, and then his mother scolded him, the father, for that.
He never told me that, but he told me a story about a balky horse he had coming out of there down that wood road one time. He had a load of wood, and the horse balked and wouldn't go. So he said, I'll fix you. So he said, I just tied it right fast there, head and feet and everything right fast to the trees, and let it stand there. And said, then after 2 hours, I said, no, I think you're cured. But he said, I went back, and he didn't go yet. So I just built a little fire under him, and to say he moved out from under the blaze.
This was Mike or his father?
That was Mike.
Uh-huh.
Mike did that.
Mike's father must have been a rather unusual person, wasn't he?
I, of course, didn't know his father. All I heard is Mike's few little recollections that he ever
mm-hmm.
gave me of his father. A very strict man, and a very strong on discipline.
Mm-hmm. Were there any anecdotes about that?
No, I don't recall any stories or so on which came down from Mike's father through him.
They lived together when the mother died. They lived together up at the head of Dry Brook for quite a while, and just the two of them, I guess.
Yes, they did. It was a log house up there. And sort of a two-room, I think, affair. Might have had a third room, but I doubt it. I mean, it was upstairs and down.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall it. But I don't know how long they lived there. Of course, then the father died, and Mike has always had a little place of his own. He had a place right here where my camp sits for now.
Mm-hmm.
This was the last place next to the last place he had in Dry Brook.
Mm-hmm.
I bought it of him and tore it down to put my camp here.
Well, when do your direct memories start of, when did you meet him?
Oh, I met Mike when I was about 18, 17, or 18. that would be 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to come up hunting. I lived in Tarrytown, New York, and a friend of mine from Brooklyn, Harry Byrne, who was in the wallpaper business there, used to come up, and we would come up and hunt and stay in a little camp right here below this. And of course, Mike was, we hired Mike as a guide.
Mm-hmm.
And he, being a famous bear hunter, why, we went with him. And as I remember distinctly all the hunts we had and so on.
What was his relationship with the people that he guided? Was he hard to get along with, or was he easy to get, or was there anything particular?
Mike was a little given to overindulgence on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him, we finally broke off with Mike, or this friend of mine did, and got another man named Dave Fairburn, who was also bear hunter, because he left us. We were very much disturbed. He put us on a runway and had a dry brook, and instead of him coming back after making the drive, he dropped down to what was then called the Lamentz Hotel in the head of the big Indian, and finally came through after we were frozen to death standing there in zero weather. For a long while. We didn't care too much about that, but it made no difference in our relations, but we had another man take us out after that, although Mike would go along sometimes. And when I say in the relation of guide, this young man who hunted with me, he didn't directly pay them. I never seen any money pass or anything. He was a
mm-hmm.
very remarkable boy that way, but he would hand out guns. He was a very wealthy young man. He
mm-hmm.
would hand out, he gave me two guns, for instance, probably worth $200. And he gave Mike a gun, he gave Dave a gun, he gave Niles Fairburn a gun, and Nate Osborne, beautiful English gun. And that's the way he handled these things, and that he was he wanted to play fair, and he played fair with Mike, and everything was all right. We straightened out the thing after a while, and we hunted with him right along
mm-hmm.
after that. But the main man who was taking this was old Dave.
Dave and Mike weren't too friendly with each other.
Natural jealousy grew up between these two men as to their abilities as bear hunters. And if I were to make an impersonal judgment between the two, I would say that Mike probably killed more bears and it was the better hunter of the two. Although Dave killed a lot of them. But they were, there was a little jealousy between them. And they would, I remember coming up out of the head of the Millbrook one night, and we were tired, we'd been way off in the head of the Beaver Kill, and then over the ridge into the head of the Millbrook, and coming up the mountain on this side. And Mike and Dave were, ahead. They always wanted to lead. In other words, that showed their superiority if they could lead the party and be the boss, in other words. Well, they got coming out of there just about dusk, and Mike, Dave was ahead, and we were 100 yards behind Harry Byrne and myself. But Mike was doing everything good to keep up with Dave, and he did, and finally he passed him, and almost at a racehorse speed, on a walk, though. Finally got to the top of the ridge, and he turned around and he says, "There, damn you, Dave, how do you like that?" I says, "You want a race show?" But that just shows the competition that was between the two. It was all friendly, but a little jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
Always on their business.
Could you tell us any of those stories about Mike and the rabbits and the animals up there at the tower? I understand that he could get them to come right up to his place there.
He could. He always told me about how the rabbits would come and he'd feed them, and I think he said he had a partridge, which heaven knows it'd be the hardest thing in the world to tame, which he could feed. And but of course he waged deathly war on the porcupines or hedgehogs, and rightly so. They're very destructive. They're timber, so on. But he kills. Well, I can't tell you how many it was, but it was well over 100 in one summer. So the told me once about the got there at the top, and the bear was there, right at the tower. But he said there was nothing happened. The bear took off for other parts as soon as he saw him, but bear was there in the past just before he got to the tower.
Was Mike? The people must have liked to come up to the tower and visit him.
Oh yes, by the hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
And his probably most notable visitor was one that you may not have heard about. He said this man came there and stayed a week. And he said, "Why?" He says, "Walt, you ought to know what that man did." He said he was a city guy, all right, and dressed up. Dressed up, he said, like a Christmas tree, all his clothes he had. But he'd be honest with you, he said he knew more than God. Well, I said, "Mike, who was he?" "Why," he said, "he was some school teacher down in New York. Said his name was Butler, I think. Nicholas Butler, or Nicholas Murray Butler, or some such name." But he said he could tell me anything about all the trees and the flowers, anything I'd pick up, he'd tell me what it was.
I guess the people, when people came there, Mike would entertain them with his stories.
Oh yes, yes. He was a noted character for that, and all the people who went there, but the hundreds, of course, they kept the guest register there, and we always used to look through it from year to year, and it would run into the hundreds that he'd have there, hundreds he'd have there in the summer. Of course, he was only on there 8 months out of the year, perhaps. And he received a great sum of $90 a month.
I understand the first tower was just a tank, an open tank or something.
I don't remember the first one, but always supposed that they had a wooden affair first.
Mm-hmm.
Then they built a road in there when Stratton Todd was for the Conservation Department, supervisor of this district. And they hauled the teams, hauled these steel beams in there to make the tower, the steel tower.
In the story of his life, Mike only tells about this one sweetheart he had that he was going to marry out in Pennsylvania. Did he have any girlfriends?
Well, at the risk of risk of being risque, we'll put it that way. nothing too bad. He, when he lived at the where John Haynes now lives, with Moot. He wasn't living with Moot, but his Moot had a hired girl who was his sweetheart. Mm-hmm. And Moot's spring was across the dry brook, and still is, to that place. The spring is up on the hill across the brook and is led over on with pipes from one side to the other, then furnishes the water for the house. Well, whenever the spring would stop up with leaves, they would have to go up and open it, which was about a 200-yard trip up the side hill. And they'd send the hired girl. So Mike's scheme was to go to the spring and shove leaves in the pipe until the girl appeared to open it, so they could have water. He has told me that story several times.
Did we ever find out that he did that?
I never heard. But Mike, of course, you know the way he'd laugh.
Yeah.
He'd tell you that, and then he'd just roar.
Did this drinking interfere with his work at the tower?
Oh, no. No. I never heard a word of complaint. Except once. You know, he got in trouble once. That was over at the Fairburn House, the very last house up the head of the Millbrook. There was a feud on between the Kittle brothers and the Fairburns. And Mike went down there, and that wasn't really the liquor. Of course, they had the liquor, but this fight started. Mike came to me and told me about it. And he said, this one Kittle man, said, I was with the Fairburns, but the Kittle fella, had an epilepsy or some kind of a fit he'd throw. And he said he laid himself down on the porch and began to rice around. And he said, and when I went over to help him, he said he kicked me right in the stomach. He said, so hard that it almost knocked me out. But he said, by that time, the fight had started good. And he said, I reached right around and grabbed an old rocking chair that was there. And he said, I swung that on this fella, and he said, I took all off the thing but the running gear off the bottom of it. And he said, they took him to the hospital, but he said, I got in trouble. He said that the department found about it, and he said, I had to get some friends. He said, to tell them it was all right, it wasn't my fault, before I got out of the scrape, but I did, finally. I always liked that part where he said he swung the rocking chair and took all off at the running gear.
Did he get into many fights?
No, no, no. Mike was not that temperament or type at all.
Mm-hmm.
I well believe he'd defend himself if he got in trouble, but I don't think he hit and could, but I don't think, you know, Mike never picked trouble at all. Mike had a habit, of course, in later years, of coming down off the tower and staying at the different homes in the brook, and which was all right. People always liked to have Mike. But after a while, of course, sometimes it got a little tedious because he'd stay for extended stay a couple of weeks or three. But, he came in here one morning, bright and early, And I was still in bed, but he got me up and he said, "Walt, I've been thrown out of Charlie Todd's across the street here."
Was this when he was still on the tower?
Oh, yeah. And I said, "What's the matter, Mike?" "Well, you say on the tower, it was wintertime, and he was not watching the tower. See, he'd make these visits in the winter, on the off month."
Oh, yes.
"He was staying with Charlie." And Charlie's wife, Mary, was, she was quite a positive woman, and she had had no fooling with her home or anything, and Charlie was a very easygoing fella, and he always looked like Mike and brought him in. But Mary didn't like it too well. So Mike didn't have very many rooms. Mike, as he goes, used to say, would drop down on the couch in the living room, and there he'd sleep, and take his clothes off now. Come one very cold night, the morning he came over here, it had been a very cold night. And of course, in those days, the plumbing was all outdoors. And Mike came over, and I said, "What happened, Mike? Why have you thrown out?" He says, "Mary said, I'm all through, and go on." Well, I said, "What happened?" "Well," he said, "I'll tell you, Walt," he says, "I don't want to be mean or anything, but," he says, "I think I was reasonable. I, in the night," he said, "at my age now, I have to get up in the night." He said, "I did," and he said, "I had my shoes off," and he said, "I couldn't go out there in that snow and ice, outdoors." And so he said, I used the sink. And she came in and caught me. Yes, I was doing that. And "Well," I said, "Mike, that's too bad. It's an awful thing to do." But I said, "That wasn't too bad. I think if you go back," I hoping all the while that he wouldn't come over and roost on me. "I think if you go back and say, 'Mary, I apologize to you. I shouldn't have done that.' But she'll say, 'All right, Mike, you can come back.'" Well, the guy, she says, "I'll try it." So he started back. 5 minutes, well, he's back again. 10 minutes, back again. "No use, Walt," he said. "No use," he says. She says, "I'm all through. I can't come there anymore." And you know, he says, "I maybe shouldn't have done that, but you know," he said, "I had trouble because," he said, "that sink was so full of dishes. That woman hadn't washed dishes all the day before." And you can cut it out if you want.
Well, that's all right. I'd like to get it down.
That's a wonderful story.
A little stronger, perhaps. I tried to say, only time he ever stayed here very long is in the days of Prohibition. We had a place over in Pine Hill. We could get applejack. And it cost us $16 a gallon, which of course was very high for anything in those days, but I saved up enough to go over and get a gallon for deer season, and I had it down under the closet, under the sink. And so, but I hadn't touched it yet. But Mike came in one day, and he said, "Have you got any drink?" That used to be his first word. Mike loved to drink, no question about that. "Well," I said, "Mike, I got some applejack and I'm saving for deer season, but I'll give you a drink, yes." So I gave him a nice generous drink, half a water glass of this applejack. It's worse than whiskey, the power of proof of it. Well, he drank that, and he stayed and stayed and stayed, and after the third day, he says, well, I guess I'll go on and down the road and so-and-so. And I went out and looked at my applejack jug, and it was entirely empty. He'd emptied in 3 days, he'd emptied that gallon jug of applejack. And my good deer season medicine was gone.
Did he ever talk about getting married and settling down?
I never heard him speak of getting married, no. I never has heard him say anything about it. No.
But up to pretty late, this whole problem of where to stay came up, because I know when he was, one summer, he was up in Ryder Hollow there with one of the Todd families, and then he said he had trouble there, and he couldn't go back there again.
Yes, well, Mike, of course, had a little place, finally, up on the Millbrook Road, house there.
Met him there.
You probably know about that.
Uh-huh.
And then he sold that. That left him with nowhere. But there's a good story about that old cottage there. You see, of course, it would stand there for months, all closed up, and the sun getting in, and the place well like that, the bees got in and so on. And he said, I went in one night, I figured I'd better go up there and stay this day. He said, I'd been out the night before, and he said, I felt awful poor. I'd had too much to drink, he said, I'll be honest with you. But he said, I got in, and I managed to get in, and I lay down on the couch there, and he said, there was a wasp lying around, he said, in there. And he said, it kept getting closer to me. Well, he said, I was so weak and bad, I didn't even try to do anything. But he said, he'd come down, that wasp finally come down, and he lit on the hand and stung me. And he said, you know, I was so full of alcohol that that wasp just flew off and dropped right dead on the middle of the table. Mike could tell a story well, and there's none of us can tell those things the way he could.
That's right. And I wonder, there were so many, many of them, that he must never have forgotten anything. Some of them go way back to this Uncle Murph Seeger that he often mentions.
Yes, when he was a boy.
Yeah.
He could tell you all about Uncle Murph and the old mill up there and the mill and covered bridge combination. The mill sat there and the covered bridge ran right along with us. And that's where the Seeger house is. It used to be up there. Yes, he had a remarkable memory. That's what I said in the beginning, that he like a great many of the Todds, are very keen mentally. When they do go out, some of them, you see, Mike's uncle was head of the normal school at Plattsburgh for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And other of the Todds have gone out and become quite prominent. They are bright, intelligent. And Mike had that intelligence, but no book learning, as they say.
He never read any books?
I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
I don't think Mike ever read any.
Mrs. Todd up at the Todd Mountain House said that he didn't believe in God. She was quite upset about that.
I don't know. I've never heard Mike express any opinion on God or religion. No, I couldn't say as to that. But he was a great lover of nature, and I mean, van who's that way. He can't be too far bad.
That's right. I think this story of the way the he would feed these rabbits up there and they would come to him when he called, that was an indication of his love of nature and knowing all of the trees and his curiosity about these things, the information that he accumulated.
Oh, he was a great lover of nature without, as Teddy Roosevelt used to say, being a nature taker. He just naturally loved it. And he knew a great many remedies. I can tell you something interesting. One day, Mike and I were, and Charlie Todd were going out to hunt this deer, and this was a very steep ridge, went right up the point. And Charlie said, I'll go up and sit on the top of the ridge, and you boys make a drive up and bring that deer, a big track there. He said, bring the deer through. And he did eventually kill it, but before Mike and I started up, Mike wasn't feeling very well. And he took a bottle out of his pocket, and in that were several colors of pills, or brown, or pink, white, and yellow. Now he said, well, here's what I do. Instead of carrying four bottles, he says, I know what each one of these is for, but he says, I only need to carry the one bottle, and I'll put them all in, mix them together, and then I take care of whatever I need. Now he says, this morning I need something for a headache, and so he took a white pill and put it back in his pocket. But he said, before I go, I got to get some balsam. So he went over to balsam tree and took his knife and pricked one of the little boils, like, because it has a sap in it. And he took that with his finger and he rubbed it all between his eyes and around his nose. And then we were all ready to start the hunt.
There was one point in his life, this was in the quite early days when he did an awful lot of poaching. Of course, then he said later on I was on the other side of the fence and he became a creek watcher for the ghouls, I guess.
Yeah, he didn't poach any more than the rest of us. In that days there was a sort of a natural warfare between the game wardens and the game warden and the natives who lived in the head of the hollow. We didn't if we wanted a piece of meat, we went out and got it. And the game wardens didn't bother us too much because they knew better. Mike told me once about he thought Joe De Silva, who was the game protector in those days, early days. Joe De Silva was asking him, and he said, I got up on this side hill, and there was a spring there, and I looked down, and there was old Joe drinking right out of the spring. So he said, I took the old Winchester, and he said, I just leveled it right off, and he said, I hit about 2 feet right alongside of his face in the water, and he said, Joe got out of there.
Now,
I can't vouch the truth of that, but...
There must have been a time around the turn of the century when life was pretty hard. I mean, in the sense that the tanneries were gone, the old industries were sort of fading away, and there wasn't as much work for local people to do. Was that the case?
Not so much in Dried Brook. Well, until George Gould came in, that would be true. Mike was a bark peeler and also a man who got out lumber and so on, as were the other people. But after the Gould people came in, they hired everybody in the valley. Practically everybody worked for Gould.
Mm-hmm.
And the farms more or less went to pot. by their stream, wherever it ran through their farm, and he would pay them what they thought was the price of the farm for the 100-foot strip or 200 feet in, on the stream, and they sold. They still maintain their farm and still work for him, but of course that condition, when George Gould died, that condition passed away. And they had to get back to farming, and then some of them did have quite a time getting these long, small dairies.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was true up Frost Valley, too. That whole valley became a big estate, wasn't it? Up down toward the west, the east branch of the Willowema comes through there. He mentioned doing some poaching over there, and that there was that whole valley was owned by one individual or two.
Oh yes, yes, there were clubs built up over in there, and certain individuals had big estates.
Mm-hmm.
The Forstmans were on the head of the west branch of the Nevesink. They had thousands of acres there.
Now the local person would come into conflict with the watchers that these estates had established, as well as the
gambling. Oh yes, yes, yes. It was a different type of proposition. You would fish with one eye up and down the brook and the other on your line.
Well, what? Where did these estates get their watchers? Wouldn't these people be very unpopular with the rest of the people in the community?
Not so much. They'd hire as much as Gould had, for instance, six watchers here on the stream.
Mm-hmm.
And it was looked at as a day's work. Some of them were more lenient than the others. Some would arrest their own mother if they found it on the stream.
Mm-hmm.
And others, of course, would be a little more lenient and turn their back, perhaps. However, the job depended on it, and it was a good job. It was nothing to do but walk and patrol day and night. Of course, they were on duty all the while. That was their job. And they did a pretty good job. Of course, the way to... they always had to carry flashlights at night, the watchers. So the boys would fish without lights, and they could always tell the stream watcher coming, but there was a flashlight coming to the river. Then they'd stone him a while, and then they'd run. But there were not too many fish lost, I guess, by the state.
I'm sure they didn't miss them.
I myself, was Niles Carbon, who died this winter.
Yes, I knew Niles.
And another fellow went over and had a beaver kill, and I hate to say so, but in those days we did these things. We came back with 208 trout, besides what we ate while we were over there.
Mm.
That's, of course, the game hogs, but some reason it was done.
Would you sell them then?
Oh no. No, they were small, the way they had water.
Uh-huh.
There wouldn't be over a big trout would be 9 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we ate them.
Uh-huh.
No.
Now, Mike, there was an article by Reuben Cross about Mike, and told about how he met him at a square dance, and that Mike would play a harmonica, play two harmonicas, and rattle his bones.
Bones, yeah.
Have you seen him do that?
Oh, yes. Yes, a friend of mine bought a little piece of property over here. This boy I taught in school. I taught high school at one time, and he decided he liked this country, he came up with me, and he bought a piece of ground, he built his camp. we decided we'd hear some old-time fiddling. So we bought 2 quarts of whiskey, and we set them right in the center of the floor. And Mike went to Arena, and to the neighboring town, and got an old man and his son, the name of Samuels, who used to play fiddles. And Mike, of course, had the harmonica in the bone. And they sat there and played and played, and of course, it was the music increased in volume with inverse proportion with the lowering of the bottles. It was a rare evening, I can tell you.
This man described him as dancing out on the floor as he did this.
Oh, yes, Mike could take to the floor. Oh, yes, yes. Rather cumbersome step that he had with. Oh, yes. Yes, those old time fiddlers were very precious. The peculiar thing about them is they would play and never crack a smile. They were just as serious about it as though they were playing in the Boston Symphony. Not a smile on their face.
I've heard tell of some of them, too, that would stop and scold the dancers.
Oh, yes, we had one old fellow played down here. I can't recall his name, but he directed the whole thing with the fiddle ball.
Uh-huh.
And call figures, and then if you didn't get it right, he would rush right down on the floor and take him, use that bow as a whip. That's a habit.
Could you tell a little bit about your own family? They came to Old Hurley first, was it?
No, in the beginning, I mean, the person I'm named after, my seventh great-grandfather, came to this country in 1657. He was a French Huguenot and came down with the Holland Dutch in New York.
Mm-hmm.
He was a young soldier in the service of the Netherlands, and he married a widow woman, Anna Hendricks, who was on the boat coming over. They came over on what's called the Spotted Cow, famous place in that case. And well, at any rate, eventually they reached Kingston and lived there for years, and down out in Old Hurley. And from there, they struck out over through up through Pine Hill country and over in the Knot, and came down, and the two brothers founded Margaretville.
Was that Harmonious Dumont?
Harmonious Dumont.
Oh, yes, I was just reading about it.
Harmonious and Peter.
Uh-huh.
My branch is Peter Dumont. And one had the what is now the Howard Davis Farm, just above Margaretville, and the other the Orville Rosa Farm, just below Margaretville. And then my great-great-grandfather,
oh yes,
owned Margaretville at this farm, and he sold it for £500.
Mm.
Went over into New Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was his name?
His name was the one that owned Margaretville. That was
yeah.
Just a moment. Well,
never mind.
Was Cornelius J. It was Cornelius. I always meant the name of King. He never had any other name but King. And I was telling someone the other day, he must have quite a skinflint. He owned 7 mortgages on farms in New Kingston. On the old J. Gould map of Delaware County, 7 of the farms in New Kingston are owned by DeMond, but
mm-hmm.
Old King had a mortgage on all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them. He must have been quite a keen old fellow. You see, there's a big span of time, and my father was born in 1834, my own father, not my grandfather, but my father was born in 1834, and his first vote was for Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
So between my father and myself, we span quite a period of time.
Yeah. Now, to get back to the Dumonts, who came over here from Old Hurley, they came before the Revolution, didn't they? Because Hamonis Dumond was killed during the Revolution.
Yes.
This book, I can't think of it, Monroe. Do you know this book about the Upper Delaware?
I've heard of it. I've never heard of it.
Because it tells the story of Hamonis' death in there.
He was shot at Arkville. They had come back, they had established these farms in the Margaretville before the war. But the trouble got so bad, and they were advised by a friendly Indian that there was going to be an Indian raid, instigated by the British, of course. So they all left for Old Hurley again, and left their places. But these Harmonis and a couple of others came back, and Brother Peter came back to harvest the crops they had in. And on their way out, they were stopped by a militia from Schoharie, who had been sent in to see about this Indian raid. And he was shot by his own militia, colonial militia.
According to Monroe, there was some funny business. This man who came in from Schoharie acted in a rather strange way. There were some other people there too, and he acted as though he was one of the king's men, a loyalist, and he asked the woman, "Well, are you still doing things for the king?" and so on and so forth, and she is thinking that he was a loyalist, sort of answered along that way, and I think that there's something strange about the whole thing.
There may have been. The story that we always have had from handed down is that this militia saw these two men riding on horses, and they called on them to halt, and they refused to halt, and they fired.
Mm-hmm.
He was mortally wounded. And of course, my people were down renters. They were in the anti-rent war.
Oh, yes.
I've heard my own father, tell about the anti-rent war.
Uh-huh.
How he was a little fellow about 4 or 5 years old, and all the Indians dressed in Indian clothes, of course, and they hoods and everything they wore, came to the house, and they called my folks Tories because they owned their own land, and somewhere they had purchased their own land and
mm-hmm.
owned it, and it didn't belong to the Livingston estate.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were known as Tories. They didn't take sides either way, and he said he was scared right to death, and he hid right behind his mother's skirt door when these anti-renters had and they hollered at him, "Pete, sorry, Pete," he said, "I didn't speak anymore." He said, "I was awful afraid of those Indians." That would be along in 1841.
Well, where did you spend your childhood?
Well, I was born in Tarrytown, New York. Sleepy Hollow, and I attended Ichabod Crane School. Was taught the Ichabod Crane. Of course, Ichabod is a character, but I was taught in school. My early days were one-room school.
Mm-hmm.
I learned more there probably than I did all the way through college and law. And it was a wonderful teacher. father was a school teacher, but all my family's been teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I myself was for a while.
Where did your father teach?
He was principal of the Union Free School in North Tarrytown.
Mm-hmm.
This is quite a large school, a little old village of about 6,000.
Did he get his education up here in the?
My father got his education at the over at the academy. The other end of the county, what's the name of that village, is an academy there. Still standing. Can't think of the name of the village, remember. But he went there, he told me that he had determined as a boy to get an education, teach school. So his mother packed 2 days or three rations. And he put them in a bag and threw them over his back. Started out of the new head of the New Kingston Valley to walk some matter of 40 or 50 miles to this academy. And he went there and got his education there. An interesting story, he said he went to the first day, they told him he had to buy a geometry book. And he went down and looked at it, bought it, and first problem was a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. And he said, I knew that, and knew any fool knew that, so I sold him the book right back. But then he went down and he taught around the New Kingston and other valleys here, and then he went down and taught what was the what is now Morris High School in New York City, went to the one-room school. He knew nothing about how to build a coal fire, so he had to call the neighbors in. He just put the coal in the grate and tried to hold a match under it. Of course, all he ever burned was wood. And he didn't know how he could get through the winter without buckwheat cakes and buckwheat flour and salt pork. So he sent to his father up in New Kingston, and his father sent down a bag of buckwheat flour, a firkin of buttermilk, and a side of pork. So they could have their salt pork and pancakes, which is a staple diet, of course.
Did he tell anything ever, any interesting stories about the teaching school in these little schools around here?
Well, he used to chew tobacco when he was a youngster, and he gave it up. He said that, I said, how did you ever spit when you were teaching school? He said that was easy. I had it on his desk and he raised the lid and he said I had a little hole in the floor. And I raised the lid and I spit right through this hole on the floor. I said I got $9 a month and boarded around the district.
Did they ever have any of those the businesses where the students barred out the teacher?
Oh yes, he told a great yarn about this one school he went to where the boys were bigger than he was. So he was quite a wrestler in his days. He broke a fellow's leg wrestling once, and he was quite an athletic inclined, I think, must have been. Because he said he knew that trouble was growing, and he had to lick somebody, as usual. So instead of taking on the biggest boy, he, at recess, he said, now, two of you, whichever two of you want, the biggest of you, come on out, and we'll have it out. So he said, and they came at me, both of them. He said, I grabbed each of them to the collar and knocked their heads together. One of them went unconscious, he said, and the other was through. He said, I had no trouble after that. There again was a man, but not never went to college. It was just an academy. You see, in those days, you didn't have to do much to teach. He was a wonderful teacher. Stayed there until he retired. He was 30-some years in that one school.
Is there any particular thing about his teaching that you remember that characterized it?
Well, he was a stickler for grammar. In those days, they stressed their grammar and parsing and diagramming and such things as that. And it was a very helpful thing, I always thought.
I think so, too. And we're getting back to it, doing a lot more than we used to.
I think it was
it teaches
very
the person
good.
To think.
His big handicap was he couldn't spell. He went to Poughkeepsie once, which is up the Hudson ways, and he wrote my mother, and there were just three letters in the whole word that belonged in there, and there wasn't another letter on it other than to do with Poughkeepsie. he couldn't spell. He married his oldest, his first year he was in school, he married his oldest student.
Uh-huh.
His first wife had died, and he had five children. His oldest son was the same age as his second wife.
Hmm.
And there are five in that generation, that's the first wife, and the three of us are still living as the second wife.
Hmm. Well, we've certainly questioned you an awful lot.